spake unto Moses, saying, Command the children of Israel that they bring unto thee pure oil olive beaten for the light, to cause the lamp to burn continually in the tabernacle of the congregation. And it shall be a statute forever in your generations. The Eternal Light. The National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Our program today, the Yiddish Press, an American primer, was written by Moses Rowell and is the third in a series entitled A Yiddish Omnibus.
Immigrant fathers and mothers, not only should you allow your children to belong to civic clubs, but it is your sacred duty to erect and equip such social centers where the character of your children will become more polished and refined.
The beginning of an editorial in a New York City newspaper. The date, 1913. The reader, hundreds of thousands of immigrants and the children of immigrants. The language, Yiddish.
Where the character of your children will become more polished and refined.
So what?
He may be right. It couldn't hurt to be polished and refined. It couldn't hurt the children, I mean.
It would hurt.
Listen to what he says about children. It is a disgrace that the richest city in the world should not be able to provide adequate school accommodation for its children. Politicians will endeavor to make a political issue out of this neglect. And the opponents of the administration will, of course, put the entire blame on the party in power. The fact remains, however, that the lack of sufficient schools in New York City has become a chronic disease. It is a disgrace to the inhabitants and to all political parties. Excuses are of no value. There must be enough schools and teachers.
Well, he's absolutely right. It is a disgrace.
The of the immigrant reader, it might be said, is what made the Yiddish press in America the vital, energetic force that it was. For the Jewish immigrant was a skeptical, hopeful, self-aware man who knew that a better world, maybe even a perfect world, was within his grasp. The newspapers he wanted were those which would talk to him in his language, would talk to him, would listen, and would talk back.
Our newspaper has received a letter full of criticism and censure, but we print it with pleasure. Here it is.
You say Jewish immigration to America is necessary. Yes, we need immigrants to build railroads, work in factories, and do hard, mean work, which the educated American no longer wants to do. But I ask you, will the Jew do this work? I think Jewish immigrants gain admission because of the immigrants of other nations, which we really need. Yes, Jews ought to be admitted. But our Jewish writers ought to tell them again and again to engage in productive work. We have entirely too many street peddlers, storekeepers, and tailors. It is high time for us to do the work our country really needs. Mine coal, mine iron, plow the fields, and reap the harvest. Very truly yours, S. Gordon, 116th Street.
Yeah, that's a good letter. Especially since it comes from an ordinary reader, and it deserves serious consideration. We agree that we really do have too many peddlers and storekeepers, though we do not agree about the tailors. True, the Jew does not dig canals, mine coal, etc. He is simply not accustomed to that work. Nevertheless, when the Jew comes here, he takes to everything. We have Jewish masons, coppersmiths, shoemakers. There is not the least doubt that if the door of immigration were open to all Jews as in the past, They would contribute to all the hard work of the country. Italians are not noted as business people or as people who seek easy livelihoods. Yet if you walk through Mulberry and Mott Streets, you see thousands of Italian street peddlers.
Yiddish, Mama Loshen, or Mother Tongue as it was called, was the language that most Eastern European Jews, the bulk of the immigrants, had in common. The Yiddish press is not to be confused with periodicals written in the Hebrew language, or in English, Russian, or German, for a Jewish readership. Yiddish, which is written in Hebrew characters, is basically a Germanic language, medieval German, with many Slavic and Hebrew words. It changed over the centuries as the Jews took it with them through their wanderings.
For all these centuries, and even today, the question, what is correct Yiddish, the King's Yiddish, so to speak, has no one exclusive answer. Vocabularies differed between Jews in Russia and Jews in France. There was highbrow and lowbrow Yiddish, and a highly Germanicized form that was used for Yiddish periodicals in America when the Yiddish presses first started to roll.
We must speak to this reader in the language of the lullabies that were sung to him, the language of his first baby words, the language in which he has sighed, flattered, mourned, rejoiced, and loved.
Thus wrote Getzel Selikovich in an early attempt at a paper for mass readership, the Yiddish Folkenblatt. Yet so delicate was the task of finding precisely that right language that even this appeal was written in a Yiddish that most readers found really too austere for their personal taste.
Well, what was the model Yiddish? Joining the challenge, the Volkszeitung wrote,
Yiddish has words of various origins and is without rules. We deem it inadvisable to have in our paper only one type. Our readers need not be surprised, therefore, if different types are used in different articles.
Yet he could not resist adding a little prejudice of his own.
We only believe it important to eliminate all Russian words from our paper.
While the search for the right language went on, the potential readership was growing. 70,000 Yiddish-speaking immigrants in the 1870s. Between 1880 and the turn of the century, another 600,000 arrived. It was in 1885 that the Tageblatt began continuous publication. Although the Tageblatt was not the first Yiddish newspaper, it was the first to become a successful daily. And for several years, it was the only daily in Yiddish.
I'm not sure I always liked so much this Tageblatt.
So what's the matter now?
It's too old-fashioned. It's afraid of anything new, like the unions, for one thing.
So not everyone has to like unions?
Not everyone had to, but many did. By and large, the Jewish immigrant population in New York City had quite a radical spirit in the fight for a better life. They had brought to America a passion for a reformed social order. Wasn't this America, where anything was possible?
The Tageblatt was rather conservative for the inspired vision of many of these immigrants, and for others it was religiously too orthodox. At any rate, it very soon inspired even frenzied competition.
I aim to make the Ofenblatt the voice of the Socialist Labor Party and the labor movement.
Yes, Mr. DeLeon.
Mr. Krantz, I don't mean the namby-pamby unions who are unwittingly the tools of the banking establishment. I mean the labor movement.
Yes, Mr. DeLeon.
Daniel DeLeon symbolized the new radicalism and the vigor of the infighting. Daniel DeLeon, a man for whom extremism was the only form of honesty. He fought the Tageblatt, he fought trade unionists who were not as radical as he, and with his Ofenblatt, he battled his way into a position of leadership in the labor movement.
His editor, Philip Krantz, much more the quiet theoretician than the rabble-rouser, could hardly keep up. De Leon's intransigence finally alienated many of his associates, who founded, in 1897,
the paper that proved to be the most successful of them all, the Vorwärts. Vorwärts, Yiddish for forward, was named for the leading socialist paper in the world, the Vorwärts of Berlin.
Its editor, the most influential man in Yiddish journalism in America, Abraham Kahn, was to guide the paper for most of the next half century. It was he who established not only the Vorwärts's style of down-to-earth Yiddish, but also its popular letters to the editor department, called a Bintel Brief, a packet of letters, such as this.
My husband reads the Vorwärts, but where does he read it? In the barber shop, where he goes all the time with those other card players. Let him see this letter.
You know, I like this Vorwärts. Look here, all about books. And here, all about the theater. And here, what's going on in Washington?
Where?
Washington, the government. And they tell you about American history. Did you know... Look here. Did you know Abraham Lincoln's famous speech at Gettysburg was only a couple minutes long and wasn't even the important speech that they gave that day?
That's what they thought? Does it say where exactly is this Gettysburg?
In Pennsylvania.
Such ambitious contents were possible because of the nature of the immigrant readership. Poor they might be, and they were used to poverty. But they yearned for knowledge, for a chance to educate themselves and their children. And even those who were illiterate knew that their thirst for culture demanded firstly that they read a Yiddish newspaper.
High spirits and idealism combined to make possible not only a wide variety of topics in these papers, but also a large number of competing papers. But the number was quickly pruned down.
Der Yiddisches Herald.
Die Tägliche Presse.
Der Call von der Ghetto.
Yiddische Welt.
Der Morgenjournal.
Der Amerikaner.
Die Wahrheit.
Morgenblatt.
Die Abendzeitung.
Der Führer.
Heinz.
Die Zeit.
Der Talk.
Vorwärts.
And Freiheit, among others. By 1923, only five of these papers were still active. And today, only the last three, Vorwärts, Der Tag, and Freiheit, still publish.
We say hurrah for the Cloakmakers Union. 7 weeks ago, the employers broke off talks with the union. They claimed they could not deal with it, that the time had come to rid themselves of it, that they could return to the old times when each worker stood alone and powerless. The union gave its answer quietly. The workers answered with a demonstration at Madison Square Garden. The cloakmakers are not friendless.
The cloakmakers are not friendless. There, what did I tell you? I told you we'd win.
Read more.
All the cloakmakers represent now a 50,000-headed giant. There are no individual scattered makers of cloaks. There is a united organization which speaks in the name of all cloak makers. Whoever wants to have factories and shops of cloaks must deal now not with individual cloak makers, but with the Cloak Makers Union. The employers do not like the union. They claim it is radical, un-American, that it has a thousand faults.
Well, what does the union say to that?
The union does not answer these charges. It worked quietly and at the same time with courage. We are proud of the union. By its calm and considerate steps, it has won a great victory and avoided a bitter struggle. Forward. July 4th, 1915.
Some of the old editorials may seem antiquated today, but they met issues that were vital in their time. Here is Der Tag addressing itself to the very real question, should a Jew become a farmer? Then, as now, there was an urban contempt for rural life, particularly among immigrant Jews, who'd always looked down on the peasants of their homelands. At any rate, in this editorial, a well-to-do Mr. Traub has registered his disappointment that his only son cannot be persuaded to pursue a respectable profession. This editorial speaks volumes about the hopes, prejudices and spirit of the immigrant Jew of the time. It is from Der Tag, May 1920. Mr. Traub writes,
"Imagine what my only son wants to become, a plain farmer. He tells me, however, that you will advise it is better to be a good farmer than a doctor, lawyer, etc."
Well, we answer with pleasure. We believe that Jews ought to give up many of their present professions and return to the work of the soil. We can prove historically that we have always been ready to do all sorts of difficult work, including farming, but that the Gentiles did not permit us to do it. We had no choice, so we became merchants, bankers, etc. They drove us to it. Now the Jewish merchant is under constant surveillance, and there is constant complaint against us that we are not producers, but parasites, for the very reason that we would want Jews to become farmers. No one can say about a farmer that he is a parasite. Everyone admits that the farmer is the most useful member of society. Mr. Traub should send his son to study in one of the best agricultural colleges in the country. If Mr. Traub's son has the inclination and ability to become a farmer, then we admire the father all the more for having such a son. More than those fathers whose sons are doctors, lawyers, engineers.
Other editorials tackled the many moral problems of big city government half a century ago, when clean government was by no means taken for granted.
The enemies of a certain candidate have issued a manifesto in which they warn the non-Catholic citizens of the state to vote against him because he is a Catholic. We must not permit such an issue to be raised. Since the opening of the campaigns, we have received several letters from readers complaining that we have not given our support to a certain candidate who is a Jew. We have decided that although this man is a Jew, we will nevertheless not advocate his election. If we send a Jew to the Senate, we want him to be clean, so that we will not be in the position where we may have to apologize for him. Die Wahrheit, November 2nd, 1914.
The Yiddish press in New York City was flourishing, and not just in New York. In dozens of cities, wherever there were enough Jews to keep it going, a paper in Yiddish could be found. Some of these papers appeared not daily, but weekly, and supplied not so much general news as specifically Jewish news. This provincial press was less idealistic, less involved with political struggle or the labor movement than its New York counterpart.
To service the Yiddish press, which was financially unable to support an army of reporters, a news-gathering network was founded that still exists today. In addition, much news came from private communiques in letters. A man in Russia would write his son in America that the garrison outside Moscow had just been transported south. And that little fact, properly jigsawed with a dozen others just as small, would result in a Yiddish press scoop about tension on the Russian border.
During the First World War, the circulation of all newspapers, particularly Yiddish papers, rose sharply. The man on the street wanted to know what was happening to his old homeland or that of his father. The Forbert, for example, was selling almost 200,000 papers a day in 1916. In the years after the First World War, two things happened to dramatically change the character of much of the Yiddish press. First, most readers had mastered English and were beginning to rely on the American newspapers for real daily news. Second, Roosevelt's New Deal policies in the 30s and the tremendous strides of trade unionism satisfied much of the idealistic longings of what had once been a very radical-minded readership. A few of the extremists held on to their views, others gave up. But the mass of the readers began to feel that the better world they had sought was indeed dawning.
During all this time, the rest of the foreign language press in America, German, Italian, Chinese, and so on, was going through similar cycles of change. The question has often been raised, why didn't the immigrant Jews, who spoke the languages of their homelands, Russian, Polish, Romanian, establish papers in those languages?
Why Yiddish? The answer seems to be that the Jew never felt himself free and at home, either in those countries or those languages. He did not usually teach his American-born children those languages. He wanted his children to learn English and to be American. The Yiddish press relied for its strength on the fact that these Jews did not feel themselves to be Jews in America, but Jewish Americans. What lies ahead for the Yiddish press in America? The use of Yiddish in this country, indeed all over the world, but particularly in this country, is declining. Readership of Yiddish periodicals in the United States within the last 40 years has dropped from over 750,000 in 1930 to 500,000 in 1940 to less than 250,000 today. Interest in Jewish affairs for Jews and non-Jews has increased, however, and the readership of English language periodicals devoted to Judaism has zoomed from about 250,000 in 1930 to almost 2 million today.
What has happened, of course, is the Jewish immigrants have accepted the languages of their host countries. There are now as many Jewish periodicals in the world in German, French, Spanish, and Portuguese as in Yiddish. And outside of Israel, half of all Jewish periodicals are in English.
To Yiddishists, persons eager to keep alive the Mamaloshen, these statistics may be cause for grieving. But the Yiddish press was never really very Yiddishist. It had other goals. It succeeded in doing what it set out a century ago to do. Integrate the Jew into a new world. And at this, it was so successful that it has nearly put itself out of business.
Most Jews come from small towns. The older ones do not have the slightest need for a newspaper. They like to hear the news from someone reading aloud. To read themselves, and every day at that, does not enter the imagination.
Ezekiel Sarason was publisher, with his father, of the Tageblatt, the first Yiddish paper to gain a real foothold in America. The uncertainties that faced the Yiddish press then bear little resemblance to the uncertainties that face it today.
The younger ones with education read a German newspaper, and gradually English ones. The enlightened, religiously emancipated readers are happy with their Hebrew language paper. And the young ones from that crowd are ashamed of even being seen with a newspaper written in Hebrew characters. So it goes.
The generation that could hardly read is gone. Their sons, for the most part, cannot understand the language of their fathers, and even fewer can read it. In between that yesterday and today, millions of readers passed into American life through the medium of the Yiddish press. It changed them, helped form them, and in so doing, changed and helped form the country. It was truly their American primer. Here is what the late Morris Cohen, for many years one of the country's leading professors of philosophy, wrote in his autobiography.
I owe a good deal of my education to the Yiddish press. It taught me to look at world news from a cosmopolitan instead of a provincial point of view. And it taught me to interpret politics realistically, instead of being misled by empty phrases. As I look back on the Yiddish press in the last decade of the 19th century, I cannot help thinking that it did more for its readers than the English language press did for its readers. Having no army of reporters to dig up sensational news, the Yiddish press necessarily paid more attention to things of permanent interest. It tried to give its readers something of enduring and substantial value. The Yiddish press prepared millions of Jewish people to take a worthy part in promoting the natural self-respect to which Jews are entitled because of their character and history.
If you would like a copy of today's script, please send your name and address with 25 cents to cover the cost of postage and handling to the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, 3080 Broadway, New York, New York, 10027. And now we take great pleasure in presenting Rabbi Abraham J. Karp, spiritual leader of Temple Beth-El, Rochester, New York. Rabbi Karp.
Each day, I read four newspapers. The morning and evening Rochester papers for local news, the New York Times for national and world news, and the Tagmorgenjournal for news of the Jewish life everywhere. Only the Yiddish newspapers provide an adequate picture of Jewish life and thought in this country, in Israel, and throughout the world. My mother reads the Forwards, so we have balance in our family reading. The Yiddish newspaper is far more than a purveyor of the news of the day. It is also a literary journal, publishing daily articles of fact and opinion, short stories, serialized novels, literary criticism, and the like. I find the reportage of David Flinker on Israel unmatched anywhere, and my favorite columnist writing in any language is Bensian Goldberg, who writes a daily column on an amazing variety of topics with great erudition, insight, and clarity. Over the years, many of the greats of Jewish literature have had their works published first in the Yiddish press, and some have been regular staff members. One can mention Sholem Asch, Zalman Schneer, Peretz Hirschbein, David Pinsky, and the poets Levick and Lessin, and today, Isaac Besheva Singer, Chaim Grade, and Elie Wiesel. Much has been made of the Yiddish press as an Americanizing agency, too much. Little emphasis has been given to the Yiddish newspaper as a vehicle and instrument of culture. To educate the reader has always been its highest priority. Often it was a particular or parochial education that was aimed at. Always it attempted to increase knowledge, elevate taste, provoke thought, and promote action. It was and is a press with purpose and direction. The Yiddish newspaper is a journal of opinion and belles lettres. It was the product of a society which had great appreciation of culture, and it helped educate the American Jewish community, which is now making so signal a contribution to American culture.
Thank you, Rabbi Karp. Eternal Light program today, The Yiddish Press, An American Primer, was written by Moses Rowell and is the third in a series of four entitled A Yiddish Omnibus. Cantor David Putterman sang the liturgical introduction. Featured today were Martin Wolfson and Mildred Clinton as the Jewish father and mother. Roger DeCoven and Paul McGrath were heard as the newspaper editors. Jay Barney and Santos Ortega as the newspaper readers. And the narrators, Guy Sorrell and Norman Rose. We invite you to join us next week when The Eternal Light will present the fourth in this series, a program written by David Roebling and dedicated to that remarkable institution, the Yiddish Theater. This is Fred Facey. The Eternal Light is directed by Kenneth McGregor and presented weekly under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This is the NBC Radio Network. Ooh.